Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. So a little bit of news from me. I mean, there's not a whole lot going on. Keep sending in emails, luke@juggler.net. I do read and respond to every email that I get. I've had some good conversations with people recently about various books and different topics and things like that. And also, if you do send me a book recommendation, don't apologise for it. Say, oh, it's not very good here, not very good here, not very good here, not very good here, but you should check it out anyway. What you should do is say, you'll enjoy this, you'll find this awesome, you'll find this awesome, you'll find this awesome. That's the way to get me reading a book that you recommend. So please keep emailing me, luke@juggler.net. News-wise, well, I'm working on a cruise ship going around the north of Scotland at the moment, currently docked near Edinburgh, and I'll be heading into Edinburgh this afternoon and this evening, because normally when I'm stopping on a cruise ship in a place, in a city, it sails away, like everyone has to be back on board by sort of like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, which is always enough time to do everything during the day, but you don't really get to experience these places in the evening. But now everyone has to be back on the ship at, I think, 11:30 tonight, so we've got a midnight sail away, which means that I'm going to be heading out and maybe, well, I'm not sure what I'm going to do in Edinburgh, but I'll go to an internet cafe, maybe look up online what I can do while I'm uploading this podcast here. Last week I was on a cruise with Juliana, my girlfriend, and that was great. I didn't have much time to read or to listen to any audiobooks because, you know, when you're on holiday with your girlfriend, well, it's a work trip for me, a holiday for her, but you're spending so much time with someone that it's difficult to keep reading all of the time when there's so much stuff going on. We visited Athens and many other places. It was great. Another thing is what I was going to say is that I was writing a diary for a whole year. I kept a diary, a daily diary, and it was taking too much time, and I decided I would take some time off writing the diary and only write a weekly kind of diary thing rather than a daily thing to give myself more time for other writing projects. And it has worked. I've got back to writing Minding Tomorrow Part 3, which I did about 45,000 words of that during the NaNoWriMo last November and then didn't work on it again. And I just started working on it a bit. And hopefully by the end of this month, by the end of September, I'll have the first draft of that finished. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back through Minding Tomorrow Part 1 and Combat, which is kind of a part 2 of that, and edit them. Because then Minding Tomorrow Part 3 will finish this story arc in this world and all the characters' stories will have finished by then. And I want to sort of make sure that their stories and the voice and everything and the themes are consistent all the way through. This is a great thing about writing books which are not being committed to paper. They're just going to be committed to e-ink and computer screens. Then nobody's printing out a final version of this story, so I can go back through and make sure that the whole book and the whole story and the whole tone of the of all three novels, or these short novels, are quite consistent. So I'm looking forward to getting to that. What else? There was another note that I made here. Oh, yes. Another reason that it took me so long to get to this next podcast episode since the last one, which I think was almost 2 weeks ago, was because I read a non-fiction book. It's called I'm Feeling Lucky by Douglas Edwards, and it's about it's called The Confessions of Google Employee Number 59, I think. And yeah, it's just about a marketing guy who worked at Google right from the beginning for the first, well, not for the first 6 years, but for 6 years of early Google. And it's a fascinating story, and I really enjoyed that it was not told from a technical point of view. All of the technical stuff is kept low level, and it's not from a programmer, it's not about this and it's not about that. It really is someone who just doesn't understand or didn't understand the way that Google works at all, as a small company, as a startup, and just never really clicked with it, and then finally found his feet within the company, in the company that there's no organizational structure and nobody really knows what they're doing at all. And then by the time, you know, then he cashed out, of course. He never says how much money he made, but he probably made quite a few million dollars with his shares. Maybe if I did the math, I could probably work out how much he owned. But all he ever says was, oh yeah, there was more zeros than I was expecting. And that's a good thing. Anyway, it's a fun book. I'm sure there's better books about Google out there. But this is a fun introduction and really explains the early history in a way that I haven't really had set out. Because like I say, he was there on the inside. Anyway, there was a reason I was going to mention this book. And it's because I am coming to the West Coast. Because of course he mentions going around San Francisco. And at the end of September, I think the 28th or something, I'm flying out to Portland in Oregon, and then I'm performing at the Portland Juggling Festival in Oregon, and then I'm going to go down and spend a week in San Francisco. So if anybody is there on the West Coast, in Portland or San Francisco, or anywhere near San Francisco, drop me a line. Tell me what's there to do in San Francisco. You know, I'm not going to visit Google or anything. But hey, if you work at Google, that'd be cool. No, if you work at Pixar or another interesting company, invite me in and say, hey, check it out, because that's the kind of thing that you can do around there, which you can't do anywhere else in the world. I'm not sure how many Googlers listened to this podcast, though. Maybe a few. Anyway, so yeah, just send me an email if you have some recommendations of things to do in San Francisco. I have about a week there. Of course, 2 days. I'm probably going to head out to the Yosemite National Park. Ah, man, I got to get onto this book. I've been talking for 5 minutes about all kinds of shit. So the book that I'm reviewing today is called Lord Valentine's Castle by Robert Silverberg, and I'm just trying to look for the, I have the Goodreads page open here so I can look up all the information about it. Yes, so it was first published in 1980, and it's 528 pages long. I listened to it as an audiobook for the first time, and it's about 20 hours, and the audiobook was narrated by Stefan Rudnicki. He's a good narrator. No one was pleased to hear his voice. I can't remember the other books that I've listened to that narrated by him, but I recognize his voice. So there it is. And this is actually the third time I've read this book. And the reason I wanted to read it was because, well, it's an audiobook. And I read this book first when I was maybe 15 years old. And I could juggle a bit, but I didn't juggle much at the time. It was just one hobby among many. And then the second time I read it was maybe 5 years later. I must have been like 18, 19 or 20 or something like that. And I was getting more into juggling. And I was maybe a good juggler, but not a professional. So it's been maybe 10 years since I read this book. It came out on audiobook last year or the year before, and I thought I'd give it a go. Now, you might be wondering, hey, Luke, why are you talking about juggling and reading this novel? The reason I'm doing that is because this book features a juggler as the protagonist, the main character, who is called Valentine. And he learns how to juggle very early on in the book, and throughout the book juggling is mentioned quite a bit, and because people know this book, it's almost like a classic science fiction fantasy kind of mix-up book. It's very well known, and lots of people have asked me over the years, hey, are you going to review Lord Valentine's Castle, because it's about juggling and you can talk about the juggling? And I've always said no, because I've read it a few times before, and then I thought, oh, fuck it, I'll just get onto it. So let's go into it. So the story, it's set on a planet called Majiripur. I'm just going to talk about the story first. So what happens is that we have this guy, and it's actually quite an interesting opening to the book, because it seemed to start like halfway through this sentence. It goes something like, and when he came over the hill, he saw the valley below, and there was a guy with some goats coming down. And I'm just like, oh, that's a weird strange. It starts with the word and the reason it starts with the word and is because the guy, who he remembers his name is Valentine, but otherwise he has amnesia. He doesn't remember his name at all, or anything more about himself than his name, and he doesn't remember who he is or where he comes from. He remembers little bits and pieces about the world, but really nothing that much about the world at all. And so he goes down into this city called Pedruid, and he discovers that the world leader, the supreme leader of the whole of the world of Majiripur, is visiting the city at the time, and the lord who is visiting the city is called Valentine. The coronel, his name is, that's the title. The coronel is called Valentine. He's like, oh, that's strange, my name's Valentine as well. Oh, and I can't remember anything about myself. And very, very quickly, if you don't work out that he is actually Lord Valentine himself, and the memories have been taken out of Lord Valentine and put into this spare body. The rest of the book is pretty much a quest of him going back to Lord Valentine's castle to try and reclaim his place as the coroner, as one of the four leaders of the world, one of the four rulers of the world. And so it's a very like a linear story. It's like a hero reclaiming the throne kind of story, which I'll talk about more later, I guess. And it's a really good idea to have someone with no memory, so as he was going through the world, everything had to be explained to him and he had to find out everything himself. But as I was listening to this, you know, just a few hours in, maybe an hour or so in, you sort of get the hint, first few hints that, oh, he might be someone important. He might have something, him and Valentine, Lord Valentine, and our memory loss Valentine might have something to do with each other. And then very quickly, he convinces the people around him and they sort of convince him that, yes, he is actually Lord Valentine with his mind been put into a different body. And yes, he should go back to the castle to try and reclaim his throne. And I was thinking, wait a sec, I thought the plot was a bit more complex than that. I remember it taking longer to this to happen. And so what happens to the rest of it? And I thought, well, do we really have like 16 hours to go till the end of the book? I thought he only discovered that he was the coronel later on in the book and convinced other people later on. But no, it doesn't seem to be that way at all. It's just like, and then it plods through to the end of the book. And I was thinking, wait, I remember the plot being more complex than this. Didn't he go there and do this and go there and do this? But then I realized actually the plot is not very complex at all. What we really have is a very straightforward hero's journey kind of thing going on with, you know, a prince, a fallen prince, reclaiming his throne. So it feels in many ways like one of these pulp adventure books, which, you know, just one guy going across and trying to, and you know that by the end of it he'll beat the bad guys and reclaim the throne and become the most important man in the world and get the girl and all that kind of stuff. But it's just a very big book, and the reason why it's such a big book is because the book isn't really, it's kind of about Lord Valentine and it's kind of about the people he's traveling with, but really it's about the setting. It's about Madripoor, I can't remember the exact pronunciation of all these things. And what we get is Madripoor is a massive world. It's a lot bigger than Earth, but it doesn't have any heavy minerals, any heavy elements in it. So there's not a lot of metal, there's not a lot of aluminium, there's not a lot of this, there's not a lot of that. Really what there is, and there's no fossil fuels either. So the technology level on this world is very... Oh no, let me just explain. It's a very big world, and the continents in this world are massive and vast and vast, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of miles across from one side to the other. And Valentine starts off right at the very far edge of one of the continents, and he has to get all the way across to the other side of the most distant continent. And you're just thinking, why doesn't he just go back around the other way around the world? But the idea being is that the world is so big that, and most of it is ocean. And the ocean around one half, say the Pacific Ocean side, the big ocean, is so big that you can't sail a boat across it. You can't sail a boat around it. And even though these continents are so big, they actually take up just a very small amount of space. So that he has to go the short way around, which is unfortunately for him a long way across all these continents. But fortunately for us, it's a long way across the continent, so we can discover everything there is to see along the way. And that's what I said, this book is really a travel guide to Madripoor. And Madripoor is, you know, it's full of forests here and deserts there, and there's these seas here, and it takes ages to, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks to sail across the seas. Even the smallest sea that they cross is about as wide as the Atlantic Ocean. And they climb this mountain and they go down into these depths and they go up here and they sail down this river and they go through this forest. And so all the time we're being, all of the plants are being described all the time. The minerals is being described all the time. All the people, there's different alien species. Well, they're not aliens because humans live alongside the different, you know, the Hjorts and the Skandars and all these different kind of alien species, which, you know, everyone just seems to get on well together. The reason why all these aliens have settled to Madripoor together is because they do get on well enough. And we learn about the native people who lived on this planet of Madripoor before the humans and the other alien species arrived, and they're called the Metamorphs. And these are these like shape changing people. I guess they're called people. We meet them along the way. And yeah, it's a big planet and there's a lot of description about it. Oh, and there's lots of people on the planet as well. There's like, I think it says something like 20 billion people, but it's not crowded. But every time they turn up to a city, we get, oh, and this city has got 20 million people in it. And this city's only got 5 million people in it. So there's lots of trade going on. There's lots of boats going here and there. There's lots of trade caravans, lots of things going on like that. So that's what the book is really mainly about. And it can get a little bit tired sometimes. But as I was listening to this as an audiobook, I could put it on 2x speed and really get the feel for the for the world of Madripoor. And I understand why people really enjoy this for the description, because Robert Silverberg can describe plants and holes in the ground very, very interestingly. And also about the setting is that I'll get more to this later, but people have been settled there for like 15,000 years, 14 or 15,000 years. So everything is very well lived in. There's not a lot of empty space. I mean, and the empty space that is there is mostly been cultivated into gardens and, you know, national parks and reserves and things like that, which again I'll get onto a bit later as well. I want to talk about some of the themes of this book. So moving on to the characters of the book, Valentine is interesting. He's very level-headed and he's very much someone who he talks his way out and talks his way into trouble and then talks his way out of trouble again. He has different people around him, so if he needs someone to wield a sword, the other people will normally wield the sword for him, but there's not a lot of that going on. It's very much like he will talk to people, and he is a trained diplomat. He's a trained he's been trained all of his life on the castle mount before his memories are taken away, to be a smooth talker, to run the world smoothly. And then when he's just dumped among the normal people of the world, he uses that to his advantage. And of course, there's some qualities about him. And it's like you're the chosen one in these books, like Harry Potter. He's the chosen one, or he's he's destined to become great. And it's a bit strange because this is one of those stories where instead of him being destined to be great, he is already great, but now he has to just, you know, make his way in the world. But it's only very slowly that he discovers how great he is, and other people discover how great he is. So Valentine, an interesting, quite likable guy. You know, he worries quite a lot about things, but generally is quite a not a fun character to spend some time with. He's very intelligent, but he's not that funny. There's not a lot of funniness in this book. Not many of the characters do much that's very funny. But then again, most of the other characters, they don't do much at all. You get the Skandar, who are this juggling troupe. They're these big aliens with four arms. I always imagine them as kind of like Chewbacca, but with four arms. And there's I can't even remember the names of them. The Skandars, Kargon Gazvol or whatever his name is, who's the leader of the juggling troupe. He's just there. He's just gruff. He's like Chewbacca, as you'd imagine Chewbacca to be, if he could speak English. That's what this guy would be. And maybe, actually, because this was written in 1980, maybe this has got something to do, you know, the mix of aliens has got something to do with Star Wars. But then I think Star Wars has probably got more to do with the mix of aliens, more to do with the kind of adventure novels of, like, The Princess of Mars and things like that. Then there's Carabella, who's a juggler, and Skeet, who are a juggler, and they're just a bit boring. Like I say, the Skandar seem to be, like, cannon fodder, and the other people who are with him, they just sort of seem to tag along all the time. And we meet this one character, and he's there, and then, like, maybe 3 or 4 hours of the audiobook goes by, and then he pops up in conversation again. I was like, oh, yeah, this young kid's been there all along. What's he been doing all this time? Well, he doesn't really have that much impact. Oh, and this character's there all along. What were they doing all this time? Oh, like that. And then Carabella, who is the female juggler, who Valentine, I think, sort of gets together with, like, right at the very beginning, second or third chapter, he meets Carabella, and they spark up a relationship, like, spark up a romance and stick together. And then all the way through to the end of the book, it's quite boring, because all the time they're just hanging out, and Valentine is there, and Carabella is there, and what's the trouble with a relationship? No trouble with a relationship. They just fall in love very early in the book, because Carabella has got nice breasts, I think. And of course, Valentine is a cool guy. He's very confident, and he's got, like, this stately manner about him. He doesn't look like a normal juggler. He doesn't look like a normal guy, because he is, actually, of course, Lord Valentine from Lord Valentine's castle. So it's easy to understand why she would fall in love with him. I'm just like, well, what's the attraction in the other way, except that she's got nice breasts and she can juggle well. Juggle good. maybe that's the attraction. But there didn't seem to be any problems in the relationship all the way through. And I'd love there to have been, like, you know, there's this other guy, Skeet, and we realize why, that, you know, he's a bit of a loner. Skeet? Skeet? Sleet? Sleet. Maybe Sleet instead of Skeet. I don't know. Sleet. And I'd really liked I know it's a mild spoiler, but this doesn't happen in the book. I'm going to say that, yeah, Valentine and Carabella were cool, but I'd have loved it that, you know, Valentine sort of helps heal Sleet in some ways. And then it would be really great if then once he was healed, Carabella fell for him like she should have done at the beginning of the book, and he fell for her, and then Sleet would have taken Carabella away and there could have been some conflict there. But there's not very much conflict in this book. None of the characters have much conflict at all. So which makes the other characters a little bit boring. Some characters, side characters that pop up, I'm like, hey, this is interesting. Oh, this guy's interesting. Oh, this person's interesting. Oh, she's interesting. And then they sort of disappear, or they're interesting until they join the quest. And as soon as they join the quest, then they just become one of the questing party and sort of fade away into the background until, you know, Valentine needs them to get out of a scrape in some way. Yeah, so there's magic and science. Oh, I didn't explain this. What happens is that because there's not a lot of metal, there's not a lot of steel, there's no fossil fuels, there's not a lot of energy to go around on this planet, the technology levels sort of fall away until most people are just, you know, farmers or traders. It's quite, not medieval, maybe more Renaissance kind of thing, where people haven't quite, there has been like metal working, but there's not a lot of metal to go around, so those skills sort of kind of fade away. And you're thinking, oh, maybe there's computers, but no, not really computers. Everyone has to just do everything by keeping records and bits of paper and all that kind of stuff. So the technology level is quite low, except, of course, as they get closer and closer to Lord Valentine's castle, to the kind of center of the administration of the entire planet, the technology level keeps going up and up, and they find more things like phasers and floating cars and things like that. And whereas at the beginning it's all, okay, we're going to ride this horse, by the end of it it's like, okay, we're going to get in this floating car and go off. Which again, sort of like that mix of technology is your sort of classic, again, to bring it back to the kind of dying Earth kind of idea of... the mixed level of technologies that you can get in one of these, this isn't so much a dying Earth, because it's a very healthy Earth, it's a very vibrant Earth, or not an Earth, it's a very vibrant planet. But like I say, that the technology level has gone off. But then you get the magical kind of stuff, and the magic, tongue around this sentence. Some people would call this fantasy, some people call it science fiction. I think it's very much a mix between the two, but it's very much stated, oh yeah, this is a world, humans came here from Earth with technology. Yes, there are aliens, and other aliens have settled here as well. But then there's this magical thing. There's a lot of dreams in the book. There's different powers on the Earth. You got the King of Dreams and the Lady of the Isle, and the Lady of the Isle sends loving dreams to keep everyone blissed out and happy with each other and to try and patch up arguments. And then the King of Dreams is there to punish people for doing something wrong. So if you commit a crime, let me get into one of these, because this is one of the themes that I want to talk about. This is a book where it's set on a world where there isn't any war, and there's no murder, and there's not much crime, and if there is much crime, it's more about misunderstandings rather about anything bad. And it's because it all comes down to these the way that the planet is run. There's four different sort of pillars of the government. There's four different powers in the world, and there's the coronal, which is, you know, the lord of the castle. In this case, it's Lord Valentine. And then there's the pontifex. I guess pontifex. That's the sort of administration kind of leg going on down there, and lives in a hole in the ground. Like I say, there's the Lady of the Isle, who sends the blissed out dreams, and the King of Dreams is the one who punishes you. So if you do anything wrong, you're punished in your dreams from then on. So really, nobody wants to commit any crimes, because if they do, they'll just have nightmares when they sleep for the rest of time. And that's cool. So nobody kills anyone, and everyone gets on well because they can track people through their dreams, and using the dreams they can see what the population of the world is like by monitoring people's dreams, and they can see what people want by monitoring their dreams, and they can see what people need, and everything is run through this kind of like the way that people dream. And I really enjoy this because at the beginning of the book, you there's this guy turns up and he's got all this money, and he goes, how much is that sausage? How about this? And he gives a 50 royal crown piece. And then they explain, no, okay, you get the quarters, and then you get the dollars, and then you get the royal dollars, and then you get the other things, and then you get this, and then you only get that. And after all of these different things, then at the top of all of them, you get a royal crown, and you just try to pay with a 50 royal crown. That's like more than 20 people will earn in a year, and you just try to use it to buy a sausage. And in any other fantasy book or any other book set in this kind of medieval kind of style, they would just get that someone would look by, and then they'd just get robbed straight away. And then that would be the main conflict of the book was, oh, I've been robbed, I'm destitute, and now I have to get my way back. I need to get riches again. I need to do this. I need to do that. Or, oh, someone has killed my friend, and now I have to avenge my friend. But nobody kills each other. There's no murder in the book. Oh, and then there's this, and we're going to have to raise an army to fight this other army. Oh, wait a second. There's no armies in this book. Why would anybody need armies? Oh, and there's this, and there's that. So it's a really strange kind of book where every source or most sources of human conflict seems to disappear. They're not worried about being attacked by bandits. Of course, they do get attacked a few times, but it's by the natives of the planet. And the natives of this planet, you get these forest people and the metamorphs who are there, and they're not part of the dream network. They're not part of the normal system. They're like they sort of fall between the gaps. So any kind of danger that comes into the book seems to come from the wildlife. It comes from the world itself, and not so much from the people within the book. And so what I wanted to talk about here is normally in these kind of books, the quest to reclaim the throne I find really annoying, because in most fantasy books, the quest to reclaim the throne is like, oh, there's a battle. Oh, and there's another battle. Oh, and there's battles here, and there's battles there. Oh, but I want to be king, and I'm not king anymore. So I'm going to become king again. I'm going to, and that's one of the main things, like the Game of Thrones, like the Song of Ice and Fire is all about, oh, they were kings. Oh, and now it's a Game of Thrones. Now I need to get back and become the king again. And for most people in these books, like for most of the population of the worlds that these books are set in the lands that these books are set in, it doesn't really matter who is king. It doesn't matter who is running things, because all it's going to be is going to be a war between two rival princes to see who's king, to then decide who is going to control the armies when they go into war next, to decide who is king over someone else. So the wars in these books are just like the king, and I don't like it. I'm just not interested who's king, because I always seem to identify more with the little guys. I just identify more with the people who are, who are fighting in the trenches, who are fighting on the front lines. I care about them more than the people who are fighting to become the king. In this book, it actually matters, because this whole system, these four different powers with the Isle of the mother of, no, was it the Queen of the Isle, the Mother on the Isle, and the King of Dreams, and the Pontifex, and the Lord and the Coronel. It's a balance, and it's a balance that affects everybody's life. And they sort of explain this as the book goes through. And this is one of the things where, Valentine himself is constantly saying, oh, should I really go? Should I really upset the system? Somebody else wants to be coronel, and they sort of tricked me out of it in a way. That's fine. Maybe I should just leave them to it. And then he's like, no, because it really can affect other people's lives. There is peace all the time. Nobody's worried about having enough to eat. Well, they are, but, generally that's not the problems. The world has been running for 14 or 15,000 years in this way. Nobody really needs to go to war. Nobody really has to be upset. But as we go through the book, we find more and more people whose lives are being affected and destroyed by the new coronel, the person who has taken Lord Valentine's place. And so it suddenly matters. And that's what I like. It's like a retaking the throne story, which has it is a noble quest that he's going on. And of course, it takes him a long time to start working this out. But then he realized, yes, what I'm doing here is the right thing. And yes, other people should be helping me, and other people do go along and help with him. So that's a nice theme, like the hero's quest with a reason. It's not just a hero's quest. Oh, I'm going to save the world. Yeah, he's going to save the world, but he's going to save the world from many, many annoyances that might build up to catastrophe in the long run. Rather than, oh, everything's going to go wrong right now unless I heal, get the ring and throw it in here, or, oh yes, I'm going to be in charge rather than you being in charge. Anyway, so I can't remember what I was up to. Oh yeah, the writing is interesting. Like I say, not very funny. I'd much rather a book with a bit more humor in than this, but it is, like you say, that I really did enjoy taking a trip across Manjipur, even though it took a long time and it was a bit long-winded. The long-windedness is good in some ways, because the descriptions are very vivid. There's a lot of sense of wonder that you get from science fiction just by going through the forests and going up the hills and going into the sea and across this way. It's lots of descriptions, although a lot of it doesn't serve the plot so well. It very much serves the themes of this being a grand world and an old world, which the order of things shouldn't be disrupted, because it's a very fair world and people should go through it. And the reading was very good. Stephen Rudnicki did a great job there as well. Oh, another theme. It's a spoiler. I'll tell you what, I'll do a spoiler section at the end of this podcast. People always ask me for that, but I will do one here at the end. So the other thing that we talk about, that we get a lot of in this book, is of course the juggling. And because I am a professional juggler, I have been a juggler now since I was, for almost 20 years I've been juggling now, and I've been a professional juggler for 8 years. And so let me talk a bit about the juggling. So, people ask me, is the juggling in this book realistic? Well, let me just sum it up for you. If you look at the front cover of this book, of the edition that I have, I'm not sure if it's on the edition, on all the editions, you get a picture of a guy who's standing there, and he's got these, and he's juggling 5 or 6 or 7 balls, whatever it is. And the balls are arrayed around him in a way which is, you'll always recognize this. If you see a picture of a clown juggling, they have their arms out by their sides, and the balls are sort of in a semicircle, like almost a perfect semicircle over their head, sort of in front of their body, but like over their head. You know the kind of picture. Now, of course, that's not the way gravity works. That's not the way juggling patterns work. It's not the way that juggling works at all. You don't stand there with your arms out to your side. You stand there with your arms in front of you. I mean, you can do it with your arms out to the side, but that's what's called a juggling trick. If you're just doing a normal juggling pattern with 5 balls, at no point, you can try and take a photo at any point, and there'll always be balls that look almost like a random pattern in the air, but they make triangles in the air. They don't make semicircles in the air. They make not random patterns, but, you know, and there's more balls at the top, because balls at the top of the pattern are traveling at a slower speed than the balls at the bottom. So when you juggle lots of balls, it looks like most of the time the balls are clumped at the top of the pattern rather than down the side. So when people draw pictures of jugglers, they always just draw this clown juggler, arms out to the side, semicircle of balls over the top of them, not thinking that gravity doesn't work that way, and juggling might not work that way. And that is kind of the level that juggling is written about in this book. Robert Silverberg has obviously seen people juggling, and he knows a little bit of the terminology. You know, he calls them clubs rather than pins, but I'm thinking maybe he calls them clubs rather than pins because 10-pin bowling probably doesn't exist in this world, whereas, you know, clubs do. Like Indian clubs, like swinging clubs might do for exercise. That's where, you know, the juggling clubs come from. So just starting off, they go through it and they get these 4-armed jugglers. And it seems to be that just because these jugglers, these Skandars, have got 4 arms, it seems that they can just miraculously juggle really, really well. And maybe because they're aliens as well, that's great. But yeah, that's cool. But then we get to the humans juggling. Now, it seems to be that when Valentine, he's never juggled before, and so they start throwing him in a ball, and he just catches the ball, and then it's like, oh, just throw it back to me into the pattern, and he does, and it seems to be very easy. And then they, oh, let's throw me another ball. Oh, and I caught, oh no, it's knives, he's juggling, oh, throw me the knife, oh, I can catch the knife, oh, let me throw it back, oh yeah, I can throw it back in, no problem at all. And of course, this is because maybe part of him has been trained in Lord Valentine's castle to be able to catch knives and things like that, but it doesn't seem to be that much, because the people, like, because later on in the book, it seems like, oh yeah, he's a good fighter, but that's not the main skills that you're taught as a coronal, as a prince, if you're going to be chosen to be the coronal. So he picks up the juggling very quickly and just doesn't drop, and then doesn't drop, and then doesn't drop. Now, on the last cruise that I was on, me and Juliana, my girlfriend, had a bit of spare time, and she doesn't juggle at all. And I am I'm a good juggling teacher. I don't teach that many people how to juggle because I'm not really at that level. If you want to learn how to juggle, you don't ask a professional juggler to teach you. You ask someone who is like a workshop teacher who teaches people to juggle. Like, not a professional, but maybe not a professional performer. But when I do teach people to juggle, I, like with my previous girlfriend Paula, she could juggle three balls, but had never juggled clubs together. In 1 year, I managed to teach her how to juggle clubs, how to pass clubs. And then exactly 1 year later, at the following European Juggling Convention, we performed in the gala show in front of 2,000 jugglers and lots of other people. So you can get to a point from not being able to juggle at all to being able to be a professional juggler in 1 year. But that's a lot of work. I mean, to be able to get that far, that's a lot of work. And I was really surprised at Juliana, my current girlfriend, how quickly she picked up some of the basic juggling. But that is because I've had experience of teaching girlfriends how to juggle before, and I know the kind of things to teach them so they don't get frustrated, and the kind of things, the easy stuff to teach them with juggling. Always start with club passing, because that's a communal thing. And I can deal with her mistakes, and she doesn't have to deal with her mistakes because she just throws all of the clubs towards me. And if she throws a club towards herself, it's tricky, because then she has to throw perfectly and catch perfectly instead of either throw perfectly or catch perfectly. And yeah, so as a good teacher, you can teach people how to juggle quite quickly, but Valentine just picks it up way too quickly. You don't learn how to juggle without dropping. The way that you learn how to juggle is by dropping a lot. And this is one of the main things that you get from life, is that you get from juggling in life that you can apply to your life, is that you're gonna fail. That's what juggling is. You're gonna fail. Thousands of for every trick that you can do flawlessly, you had to do it hundreds of times, thousands of times badly before you can do it correctly. And in everything that you do, it doesn't. And that's one of the things that I really actually quite enjoyed about this book, I'm Feeling Lucky, which is about Google. It's like, hey, you can fail. We'll do this thing. You can have your 20% time. Just do this. Did it work? No, it didn't work. Doesn't matter. Just move on to something else. There's no art, you failed. That's the last time you can try that. And this is a book about juggling, or about jugglers, this Lord Valentine's Castle, where there's no failure. There's no drops. He goes out and he does his first show and he doesn't drop. I can tell you that if you're going to do a juggling show, the first time you do a juggling show, you're going to suck. And the second time you're going to do it, you're going to suck. You're going to drop way too much. You're going to overextend yourself. You're not going to do anything. Here's a bit of a story. I mentioned a few weeks ago, actually, on the podcast, that I was very proud of myself, because after over 4 years worth of doing my show on cruise ships, for the first time, I managed to do my 50-minute juggling show, which has got quite a bit of juggling in it. But I managed to do it dropless. I managed to get all the way through without making any mistakes. I make mistakes on purpose. Like, I drop on purpose and make it look as though I'm making mistakes on purpose. But I managed to get all the way through with no unchoreographed mistakes. And that's 4 years worth of being a professional juggler. This is how I earn my money. 4 years of juggling, and I've managed to do my show once without any mistakes. And in this book, like every performance, it's like, hey, we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to do this routine, and we're going to do this more complex routine, and we're going to do this more complex routine. We're going to have someone in the troupe who's only performed with us for a few weeks, and it's going to be flawless. And then once or twice it mentions, oh, and he was so nervous, he even made a drop. And I'm like, wow, this is so not cool. And I remember, and I talked to other jugglers, and I know these other people. There's a guy, Jay Gilligan, who performed in Berlin for like 3 or 4 months, and he was performing not like I do. I only perform like maybe 3 or 4 nights a week at the most. Three or four nights a month at the most, because I do longer shows. But he was doing his juggling routine, I think, 6 times a week. And in 3 months or 4 months or something, he was doing it. He managed to do it, him and Matthias, he managed to do his juggling routine twice without any mistakes. It's just like, making mistakes on stage is what jugglers do. I mean, some jugglers can do it. I mean, I could do a routine without making any mistakes time and time again. There are parts of my show which I do time and time again. But jugglers make mistakes. That's what they do. And it's really interesting to see these shows. Oh, here's another thing. how long can you can keep somebody interested, interesting? No, how long can you keep them entertained and interested in the juggling? I would say if you're just going to juggle and you're just going to do some patterns, you could probably keep people entertained for around about 6 or 7 minutes. That's around about the length of a normal variety routine. If you're the best juggler in the world, if you're like Anthony Gatto and you're just out there just purely juggling, just doing patterns, just doing tricks, just doing, you know, a trick and then a harder trick and then a different trick and then a harder trick, you can keep it up for maybe 11 or 12 minutes. If you've got a big group of people, you can keep it going for maybe 20 minutes or something. We're swapping in different people and doing different skills and different different props, different objects, juggling different objects and different styles. That is pretty much the extent. Once you get longer than that, then you've either got to be performing for jugglers who understand the juggling, what's going on, or you've got to start doing more theatrical kind of things, or like that I do in my show. I do more theatrical stuff and character comedy and physical comedy and some spoken comedy, and I do audience interaction. And by that, the other night I did my show, the ship was moving quite a lot and everything took a bit longer, and I swapped some stuff around in my show so I didn't knock myself out on stage like I did last year. And my show lasted 60 minutes, which is too long, but you know, people stuck around for it. Any longer than that, it's really, really, really difficult just to do juggling and to keep people entertained. And time again in this book, it talks about the jugglers going out and doing like an hour and then another hour and then 3 hours worth of juggling, and people still being entertained and still clapping along and still paying them money. And without dropping, by the way, all of that time. And I'm just like, what are these guys doing? What is so amazing? Or is everyone just like mesmerized like a baby looking up at a mobile hanging above them and going, ooh, good, 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 movement, little pretty lights or something like that. How long can you... And this, let me explain. This is the reason why I am a professional juggler and that I can keep working and doing my show on cruise ships. It's because not many jugglers have a long show like mine, who can do 50 minutes worth of entertaining juggling and then do another show of another 25 minutes worth of material. I'm not the best juggler out there, but I'm an entertaining juggler. I can use my personality and humor and, you know, video projection and music and songs and all these different stuff that I mix together into my juggling show. And not many people, especially in Europe, do that kind of thing. There's probably only about 5 or 6, you know, jugglers, professional jugglers, who do the same kind of thing as I do in Europe. Quite a lot more in America. But that's why I can keep working, and that's why I have an awesome job and an awesome lifestyle. Is because it's really a hard job. It's taken me, you know, 20 years of juggling and 8 years of being a professional to get my show to the level it is at the moment. So that's good. What else is in this book? I made a note here. Oh yeah, blind juggling. That's sort of set out by Sleet to be like the most difficult thing in the world. Actually, pretty easy. Once you've got a pattern, you know, once you've got a solid pattern, you can learn blind juggling quite easily. You don't do it by the hearing the balls. Although I did once teach, I used these chain mail kind of balls, which are like chinky, chinky, chinky balls. And I actually taught someone who was blind to throw and catch a ball. And I did manage to, I think he managed to get up to 4 or 5 catches, a blind guy. He could slightly see, but you know, you can actually start off with a blind person and teach them how to juggle. And if you've seen these videos of these juggling robots, there was one that went around a few months ago, and it was juggling 5 balls. It can't see. Oh no, that one can. But you can make juggling machines that can't see the balls. They just, you know, just by the catching motion and throwing motion is so flawlessly set up. So if you've got a solid pattern, you can juggle. You can juggle 3 balls or 3 clubs for a long time. At the European Juggling Convention, there was this guy who decided he would break the world record for 3 club juggling blind, and he did it for about 45 seconds on stage or 50 seconds on stage. And I was like, I've been at like 3 or 4 minutes blind before. And anyone who's a good juggler has trained juggling without being able to see. I even used to do that in a show, actually. I used to do blindfolded knife juggling, although it was a gimmick. I could actually see through the blindfold. Another thing that happens is juggling seems to get your ladies. Yep, it can work. That can work. But I think you've just got to be cool anyway. I mean, I've used juggling to get myself dates and to get sex before. Might as well say it. And yes, it can work. But it does help if you're a good juggler. And I think if you're just a cool person. Not cool, but I don't want to say that about myself. If you're good looking, I'm not that too hard on the eye. Anyway, but juggling does help. Yes, it does help. Let me say it that way. If you're like an average guy like I am, not too bad looking, juggling can set you apart and help you get sex. And also in the book, it seems to be that he uses juggling to get through places. It's like someone comes up and he's going to beat them up and they're going to go. And then they all do a juggling show and they're like, oh, that's cool. Another time they're at this place and they need to get through and everyone's ignoring them and they're not. And they do a juggling show. Oh, and he gets through. Now, this can work. Now, when I go through immigration, sometimes they're like, hey, what's in your bag? And if I said, oh, it's my gear to do work, and they'd be like, hey, you're not allowed in America anymore if you're coming over here to work. And I'm like, yeah, I'm working on a cruise ship. And I have been turned away, and I have been, like, not turned away. I once couldn't get on a flight because I was traveling and I didn't have the right visas. Not a work visa, because I don't work in America. Actually, I don't get paid for working in America because I'm working in international waters on the cruise ship. And if I go to a festival in America, I don't get paid. I just get a tip, I guess you could call it. So if I, like, when I went to Israel, they're like, what are you doing here? I'm juggling. What is juggling? What is jiggling? They said, I was like, you know, juggling. And then I got some juggling balls out and juggled for them. I'm like, oh, that's great. No problem at all. If you're a juggler, you must be harmless. Just go straight through. No problem at all. And when I was going to New York last year, they're like, what do you do? I'm a juggler. What? He's looking through my passport. It's like, what do you do all this time? Yeah, I juggle. I go all around the world and juggle. And they're like, oh, that's cool. So just saying that you're a juggler does disarm people and can get you through different places. Quick edit here, recording this a little bit later. I've remembered two other things that I was going to mention about the juggling here. One of them is that at one point they say, oh, and Valentine had been juggling, oh, it mentioned his strength or something. It's been, yes, and because he had been juggling for months, and months of training of juggling had really made him strong. It doesn't really work that way. Juggling isn't sort of like an aerobic activity. I mean, if you do it quite a lot, I mean, I get work up a sweat, but it's not like going running or lifting weights or anything. You get good muscles along your back and along your arms, but you know, you get weedy chest muscles. You're like the opposite of a pigeon in that way. And another thing is, a few times they mention that, oh, they picked up the juggling knives and used the juggling knives as weapons. Now, I use juggling knives in my show all the time, and they're the bluntest blunt objects that you can have that still look even remotely like a knife. So anytime that you see someone juggling knives, they're not real knives. Anytime that you see people juggling flaming torches, they are it is real fire, but you can pretty much catch the wrong end of a flaming torch and just flip it around in your hand again without damaging yourself. Chainsaws are a different matter. Most people who perform with chainsaws use gimmicks chainsaws, which aren't so dangerous. But there are some people who do the world record attempts, and if you do a world record attempt, you have to have a running bladed chainsaw, but they're not real chainsaw. They're like toy chainsaws, almost with these long handles that get clamped onto them to make them easier to juggle. So there's another two things as well. I think that's all I can think of now. So let me just wrap this up. Email me. Oh no, 3.5 stars for this book. It is a bit long in some places, and the description's a bit long, but it is a lot of fun, and it does have sort of some kind of nostalgia value for me of a book that I've read twice before, and now once again as an audio book, it was quite good. But I understand if people don't enjoy the story so much, or if they think Valentine is a bit boring. But I do think this is a book about a situation where, yeah, I think it's a statement that a juggler, like one of the professions that you could have on Madripoor and, you know, travel across Madripoor, is as a juggler. And normally in a fantasy book, you've got to be like a slave, or you've got to be a soldier, or you've got to be a trader. If you're a trader, that's a really good job. Whereas in this book, in this world, everyone seems to get on quite well, and, you know, entertainment plays such a big part in it. And I think that's interesting. What was I saying? Yeah, 3.5 stars. Could be better. A bit long-winded, and some of the characters a bit boring. I'd wish there was a little bit more conflict, and some of the characters took a bit more place in it, but I think I'm just repeating myself. So email me, luke@juggler.net, if you have anything to say about this book or any other questions, and if you're in San Francisco and have got interesting things that I could do. Follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on Twitter. You can follow my blog. I'm posting more to my blog now that I'm not keeping a diary anymore. More things are going to be going up on my blog. That's lukeburge.com/blog. Or you can check out my own fiction. Another reason why I wanted to read this book is because another book that I'm reading called Arc of Life is a kind of mix of science fiction and fantasy. It's much more fantasy than this book, and the science fiction is much more in the background, hopefully. Now that I've stopped writing my diary, hopefully I'm going to see if I can get that finished by the end of November. I'll see if I can finish that as part of the NaNoWriMo thing, write the last 50,000 words of that in November, see how that goes. Anyway, that's it. Oh, goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. You can find my review on here and comment directly on my review of this book there on goodreads.com. That's a good way to get back to me about this, because then other people can see your comments too. So here's a spoilerific section, just the very end of this. Stop listening now if you've not read it. So at the beginning of this book, we find out that nobody dies, nobody's murdered, nobody ever wants to kill anybody else, because you know, the King of Dreams influences their dreams, and that's bad, and they couldn't live with themselves anyway. And then, so that's the reason why, instead of just taking Valentine's body and replacing his memories or the mind in his old body, that's why they don't just kill him, and that's why they leave him just wandering around, because they don't want to kill him. And if they strand his mind over there, that the people with the dreams, who keep track of people through their dreams, they then can't track him down, because he's wandering in a different body and it doesn't matter. But they can't kill him. And then we find out that the metamorphs can kill people because, hey, they're metamorphs and their dreams are influences. And here's the massive spoiler for the last, you know, half an hour of the book, the last hour of the book. We discover that the people behind the plotting, the people plotting behind the replacing his body, are metamorphs anyway. So why, if there's metamorphs around the place and metamorphs can get away with killing people, why didn't they just kill him at the beginning? Now, if you can explain this massive plot hole in this book, did I miss something here? Why, if metamorphs don't have their dreams affected, and that is the reason why people don't kill people or don't have people murdered, it's not just the killing people, it's even the plotting to kill somebody, like second-hand plotting. If it's in your dreams, they find out about it through your dreams and then affect your dreams from then on. Why didn't the metamorphs just kill Valentine once they took his body? And if they're metamorphs and they can replace one of the powers of the book, like, massive spoiler, they replace the King of Dreams with a metamorph. If they can just replace someone with a metamorph that easily, why didn't they just replace Valentine with a metamorph and kill him? Why didn't they just do that like they did with the King of Dreams? Why didn't they just do that with Valentine as well? And why didn't they do that with the Pontifex? Well, I can understand why not with the Pontifex. But and why didn't they do it with the... Why didn't they just do it that before? Yeah, so if you can explain this plot hole, please email me, luke@juggler.net. That's all I'm going to talk about today. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.